Thanks, Mark. Well, good evening to all of you. Nice everybody could make it here safely. That's always good. If I don't know all of you, I probably did know you, and maybe you were a little smaller walking around down here. I probably know your parents and even your grandparents and maybe even your great-grandparents. Yes, probably. Anyways, Aunt Sue and I, we used to live out here in Michigan a while back. It was like way back. 4 years ago, and spent all our life here. Used to come to Attica every year as well, but we moved out to California. You can ask James about California sometime, and it's a nice place to come and visit. Anyways, we've been out there for 4 years, but it's nice to be back here. So thanks for having us back, and it's fun to be able to come back here and speak to you at this gathering this weekend, even though I realize none of you had the official authority to invite me, but it's nice anyways that you let us come. So hopefully we're going to have some fun this weekend having a look at the challenging subject, though, of living as a member of God's family. And I think it's a fun one to look at because this is what it's all about. You know, we know we're at the end times. The events that are happening in our world today certainly indicate that Christ's coming could be any day. And we want to be ready for that day when he returns. And this is our opportunity now to practice living as a member of God's family. So that's the basic strategy of this weekend, is to look at and challenge each other about, well, what are we going to do when you go home? This weekend is supposed to change your life. This is not just somewhere where you come and just have some fun and go home and just go back to the old grind. But really what you want to do when you go to Bible schools and gatherings is let them change your life. And hopefully this weekend you'll get challenged on some things about maybe when you think about it on the way home. What would you like to do different when you get back home? What can we do to improve our walk before God? So that's the kind of stuff that we're going to look at. And then tomorrow night when you're all wiped out and tired and you don't want to think about that, we'll do some stuff on the Bible and science tomorrow night. And hopefully that will be interesting to some of you as well. So that's the basic strategy. And this class here is about what does God require of you. Now, when you look at this subject, though, about what God requires of us, this has been a consistent problem in religions for years. You go back and look at religious organizations, you know, back as far as you can go, there's always been some great debate about what does their God want out of them. So you could go back to the pagans, for interesting, and you could go back and look in the period of the kings, where you see like in the pagan sacrifices that they would have. And you see in the readings even, and we've read in Micah about, well, what does God require of us? You know, does he want us to offer up our son? Should you offer up your brother or your sister at home? Would your parents, would that make them right with God if they took one of you and offered you up as an offering? Because that's what they used to do. Remember, Ahab did that. He offered up his children and passed them through the fire to Molech. Well, you go back to the Jews. You look at what Jews did. Well, Jews thought what God wants out of them is he wants them to follow all this rigid law. And they have to do it in such a way that they keep track of how they're doing. And in the end, they're going to go to God and say, well, look, we've been weighing it all up. And I've done all these good things, and I've got a few bad ones as well. But my good ones way outweigh the bad ones. And so, you know, I'm acceptable to you. And that's what the Jews would do. That was their basic approach to life. Then you have people in religious groups today who think that, well, the way to get to their reward is you can just go through and be a suicide person. And that this is their fastest way to heaven. You just offer yourself as a suicide victim and do some great event for your God like that, and then their God is going to reward them. Or we have people around today that the Salvation Army and different religious groups that just figure that whoever does doing the most good, this is the way you're going to earn your way to God. And that's not really what we're going to find is the answer this weekend. Although those things may sound good, and even the humanistic approach of just seeing whoever is doing the most good, that they're the ones that are going to make it. That's not what the Bible presents, though, is what God is really after. So we're not going to use the goodometer there and figure it out that way. Instead, what the Bible does is it makes it very clear to us that what our God is doing is he's creating a family. And what do you want? He loves to have children. You find this so clearly in the Bible, that what God likes to do is expand out his family, invite more people in, and keep adding to his family. And we know that the angels are already part of this family. You know, as many as there are of the angels and where they all came from and how many creations there were to create the whole community of angels that we have, we don't know. But we do know that God loves to add to his family. And so what he does is he offers us a gift. And he says, look, you can have this, and it's free. And this is what our God does. He says, you can have the free gift. I'm going to invite you into the family. Not everybody in the world today gets invited in. You might not think that's fair, but it's hard for God to save people. So he invites, he picks people. He says, I'm going to invite you, and we're going to invite you. And sometimes he invites people because their parents have been praying for them, or maybe their friends have been praying for them. And he invites them into this family. He calls them. He doesn't call everybody today, but he's called you. And that's why you're all here this weekend. You have been called. You're in a situation where you've been exposed to God's truth. And he's bringing you towards his family. And what he wants to do is he wants to save you into his family forever. But you're never going to earn that. You can never do any great thing to earn it. So what he does is, look, I'll give it to you as a gift. And then I'll just see whether or not you really appreciate it. Is that what you really want? And that's what God does. It's a whole different way of operating today than what we're used to. It's not like your employers. It's not like your teachers at school. It's not like that system at all that you're so used to, where you're always under the gun, where people are watching you, they're grading you, and they're rewarding you on the basis of all the stuff you do. That's not how God's system works. And hopefully this weekend we'll get a chance to look at that. God has offered us something which is a free gift of God, and all he wants to do is find out whether we will respond to that. Is that really what we want? Now, funny place to start this weekend is Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy 29 is it's the end of Deuteronomy, and who knows, when was the book of Deuteronomy, when was it really put together? Because you got Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. When did that book get put together? When is this? Moses is still around, right? Because it talks about which the Lord commanded Moses to make, right? So Moses is still around. Where are we in Moses' life right now? We'll start there. You know? The very end. In fact, how close are we to the end? Maybe the last, not the last day, but maybe the last month. You're in the last month of Moses' life. You know, when he wrote the book of Deuteronomy, he gave it all in one month, and this is the last month of his life. So, for 40 years, the children of Israel had been wandering around. They left Egypt, a bunch of heathens in Egypt, and all those people came out of Egypt, and God brought them out to Mount Sinai, and he brings them to the mountain, and the angel comes down, and the mountain thunders, and it's on fire, and there's lightning, and there's wind, and there's all those things, and he thunders out the Ten Commandments. And how did the people respond? Did they want to run up and meet God? How did the people respond? What did they do? What did they do, James?
They ran away.
They took off. They ran away. They were spooked. They were scared. They were so scared, they never wanted to come and develop a relationship with God. They never did. And that generation of people, because they never learned to trust their God, they never developed any relationship with him, and in the end, they couldn't enter in the land because of unbelief. They never really had any faith in their God. They were spooked. They were scared. And that was what they did. They ran off. And in the end, that's what happened with that generation. But in Deuteronomy 29, Moses realizes we're at 40 years have gone by. And these people have had this law for 40 years. And now they're going to go into the land and they're going to set all up and they're going to start implementing the law and the tabernacles. They're going to take it in the land. And he realized that this group of people, that are, if they're going to make it and go in the land, they've got to be different than their parents. And so their parents, they were sort of locked in, spooked out by God, thinking that somehow with this law they were going to earn their salvation. So what Moses did in Deuteronomy 29, you may have never even noticed it during the readings, but did you realize that he made another covenant with the children of Israel besides the covenant that he had made with them in Horeb? Because the one in Horeb was the Ten Commandments one. That was the one where they got spooked out, and all it was do this and do this and you can't do this, and it spooked those people out. And he goes on and tells them that now we're going to make a different covenant, a different one. And this one, you know, he recounts with them, look at what God has done with you this day. He says that the Lord had not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and ears to hear to this very day. And he led them 40 years in the wilderness, and your clothes haven't worn out. God had done miraculous things with them. Your sandals had not worn out on your feet. You've not eaten bread, nor have you drunk wine or similar drink, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. And when they went to war, when they fought against Sihon and Og, they conquered them. God had allowed them to do miraculous things. So he says, therefore, keep the words of this covenant, this one that he's going to give them, which is a new covenant besides the one that was done in Horeb. And when he describes this covenant, when you're looking through Deuteronomy 29, you'll notice he says, this one is with all of you. Everybody who's here today, and also different from the Jewish kind of thing, this is for everybody, including the stranger who's in your camp. All those people, from the one who cuts your wood to the one who draws your water, that you may enter into a covenant with the Lord your God, into his oath, which the Lord makes with you, God makes with you today. He's going to establish you today as his people. And he goes back and he recounts, just as he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This covenant is tied in with the Abrahamic promises. This is the Abrahamic covenant that he's trying to restore with these people today, not the Mosaic covenant. And it's a different one. And a lot of times when you're doing the readings, you don't even notice this is going on. So he makes this covenant with everybody who stands here with us today before our God, as well as him who is not here with us today. So this one's based on the promises to Abraham. Now, as he's going through this covenant in Deuteronomy 30, because it's great to follow through what actually happens here. In Deuteronomy 30, Moses realized that what people wanted to do is very much like the pagan idea, where you end up thinking that in order to get a covenant with your God and for your God to like you, you've got to do something really special. What can you do? You got anything really special you can do? You good at anything? You got to be good at something, right? Well, if you're not good at something, then what you do is you offer up your friend and say you'll take care of him. So you can do that instead. That's what you do. If you can't do some great thing yourself, you offer up the other guy. And so that's what the pagans used to do all the time. But this is what would happen, is that people were thinking that for their God to save them, somebody's got to do something really miraculous. You've got to do something stupendous. You've got to do something to make it like you're worth saving. I mean, isn't that a common view today amongst people? They all think we've got to do something so that we're worth saving. Some spectacular event. And so what Moses did in Deuteronomy 30 then, he says, as you're going through this right here, he says, it's this commandment that I'm giving you today, this oath that you're making, this covenant, that it's not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. Because you got to remember, these kids now that are standing there, they realize their parents didn't make it. That whole generation, they watched whatever it was, over a million people probably die off in 40 years. And their feeling might be that, well, we're not good enough to make it either. We got to do some really spectacular thing or we're never going to make it. So he sets out for them. He says, look, it's not up in heaven that you've got to ask who's going to go up to heaven to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea so that you have to ask, well, who's going to cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it. No, the word is very near you. It's in your mouth and in your heart so you can obey it. And so he says, look, I've set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commands, decrees and laws, and then you will live and increase. No, you don't have to do something spectacular. You don't have to do some fantastic thing. And yes, you can make it. He had to convince these people that you can do it. You can actually make it, even though the generation before you, your parents, didn't make it in the land. Now, if you think that's a little far-fetched, what the Apostle Paul does is in Romans 10, he quotes this section. And he does it for this very reason, because he realizes how Moses used it. And he goes back and reminds the people in Romans 10, in the section in Romans in chapters 9, 10, and 11, which are all about the failure of the Jews, and how God will at one point save them and regraft them in. For the moment, the Jews had been cast off. They'd been plucked off the tree of life, in a sense, of God's life, and the Gentiles were being incorporating in. So in Romans 10, Paul says in verse 1 there, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own righteousness, they haven't submitted to the righteousness of God. Now, that right there is what the Jews were famous for. They thought they had to do all these things and pile up all their good things and present them to God and say, look at how good I am. And here's all my righteousness. So they were on the good-o-meter thing. They were really good at that. They would like balance out the bad things they did, the good things that they did, and try to like make it like, oh, my good things outweigh the bad ones. Therefore, I am worth saving. And that's how they went about presenting the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law. And that word end there doesn't mean that it was really the end. It means it was the goal. It was the aim of the law. For righteousness to everyone who believes. But the Jews didn't understand this. So he goes on and he says in verse 5, Moses writes about the righteousness which is of law, that the man who does these things shall live by them. Right? Because that's the way the law was written. It's all about you doing this and doing this and doing this. And it was a national code, and God did promise to bless the nation that way. But in verse 6, the righteousness of faith speaks this way. Do not say in your heart, who's going to ascend into heaven? That is to bring Christ from above. Or who will ascend into the abyss? That is to bring Christ up from the dead. Now, where's that from? Did you catch it? Where's that from? Deuteronomy 30. He's quoting Deuteronomy 30, and he's showing you what it could mean. This is what, you know, people would think that, oh, I gotta go up there and get the Messiah or be the Messiah or something like that. I gotta go up there and do some spectacular event and bring Christ down from above. Or I've got to like raise him up from the dead or something like that. No, you don't have to do some spectacular thing. What does the Bible say? He says, what does it say? Moses said, the word is near you. It's in your mouth and in your heart. And that is the word of faith which we preach. So that if you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. No, you don't have to do some spectacular thing. You don't have to do something to earn it. That's not the way it works with God. Whoever believes on him will not be put to shame. Now that word believes right there, and some of you probably know that that's really in the Greek, that's the same word as having faith. We don't have an English word for like faithing, but if we did, if you had a verb for faith or something like that, we'd call that, well, whoever faithings on him or something like that, whoever has the faithing will not be put to shame. Because that's really what that word is, that when you see that word believed or when you see that word have faith, it was all about faith in what God will do, not what we do. And this is the key to understanding the becoming part of God's family. All the people who are invited into God's family and who make it in the end, including the angels, all understand that you can never do anything to deserve it. There's no spectacular event that you had to do to get there. What God was asking for all along is that you trust him, you believe in him, and that you simply in your heart believe it, you confess it with your mouth, and you live God's way of life. That's what he always wanted. That's all he's ever wanted, to be a member of his family. But it's really difficult to convince people to actually do that. That's the problem. So in terms of like what, or after this weekend, what I want you to do is get a relationship with God and with the Lord Jesus Christ. Get closer to understand what do they want from us? What are they actually doing with us today? And really, I think a good way of looking at it is to understand in terms of sports teams today that God is like the best coach you could ever have. If you ever played sports, how many of you have been on a sports team of some kind? You had a coach in your life? All right, probably a lot of people have. All right, God's the best coach. This coach you can trust. He knows the team. He invited you on. He knows the game plan. He's got it all figured out. And what are you supposed to do when your coach says, if the coach says, hey, we're going to play this way, this is the way we're going to go at it, are you going to look at him and say, oh, no, I'm not going to do that? You're going to be sitting on the bench. That's what happens. And this is the way it works in God's family. He's got the game plan all figured out. And he's already put it down for us. And he says, look, all you got to do is follow it. Just follow the game plan. I promise you, you'll win the game. He guarantees success. So he sets the game plan. He financed the team. He bought us all with the price of the blood of his son. That's what he did. He chose the players. As Jesus said, that we have been chosen in him from the foundation of the world. He sets the game plan. As Paul says, like, who's known the mind of the Lord, or who could have been his counselor? He's got this all figured out in ways that we could just never even imagine. And he guarantees success. Who's going to separate you from the love of God? Who, Paul says? Tribulation, distress, or what? You know, political things? Who's going to separate you? God guarantees that you will make it if you play on his team. And he knows what you need to play on his team. He knows everything before we even ask. That's why Jesus is going to say in the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6, you don't have to say a whole lot when you pray. He already knows what you need before you even go to ask him. This is the coach that we have. He guarantees that we're going to win the game. All we got to do is play by his rules. The problem that we have in life, you know, for all of us, is that most people don't listen to the coach. They don't really want to play God's way. They don't really trust him and say, you know, this is right, this is the way it should go. And instead, what people do year after year, day after day, is they choose to go their own way. That's what they'll do. They don't read the playbook. You've got the playbook sitting right in front of you in the Bible. There it is. That's how to play the game. And all you got to do is follow that, and he guarantees that we'll make that. Because we'll learn to love him, and we'll learn to serve him, and it will just change your life, and you end up walking in his ways. So that's the great thing that we have about our God. Now, in Micah chapter 6, Micah was dealing with a bunch of people and the children of Israel. They were Jews. And when he wrote Micah 6, the beginning of the chapter was all about the fact that the people were sort of tired of coming to God. Be like all of you coming here, you're Jews, and you've come to meeting. And what did the Jews spend a lot of time doing when they came to worship? What did you have to do? If you're going to come and worship and you're a Jew, what do you have to bring?
Your sacrifice.
A sacrifice. So you got to get one of your animals, you got to bring it, you know, you got to cut it up, and you got to go through all this work. And so the Jews would come, and they'd come to meeting, and they'd say, oh, this is so much work, and they're so tired of it. You know, do you really want to do that, like week after week, and month after month, and year after year? So in Micah 6, at the beginning of the chapter, that's what they say. They say, look, they've wearied God. And God says, what do you mean I've wearied you? You know, you really think that's the case? I've been trying to save you. You know, did God really want you to bring all those sacrifices? Did he really want all those?
My obedience.
He wanted obedience. That's what he really wanted. He said, look, I never told you to bring all those sacrifices. What I really said in the beginning was, obey my voice. Obey me. That's what I really wanted. You messed up. And because you messed up, I had to retrain your brain so that you could learn to be obedient. And that's what the sacrifices were all about. But I didn't really want all those sacrifices. I really just wanted obedience. That's all he really wanted. So when Micah says to him in verse 6 there, when he says sort of rhetorically, what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? You know, shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? Is that really what he wants? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Is that, you know, like the pagans would have done? They would have offered up their kids and figured out, well, that way they can appease the anger of their God or something like that. But he says, look it, he has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? That's what you want to leave here with this weekend. That's the part we have to play. We've got to learn to walk like that before our God. Not some stupendous, fantastic act. No, he just wants the still, small voice of daily walking with justice, treating people kindly, showing mercy, and walking humbly with our God. And what he's doing is he's creating a family of people who live like that. And what he's put before us is he's put the angels out there in the Bible so that when you read about the angels, you realize this is how God's family members behave. We think about what angels do. Like, for example, when the angels showed up to Abraham and they wanted to deal with Abraham and they wanted to tell Abraham, you're going to have a son. Abraham, you're finally going to have a kid. And they're excited about telling him about that. What did Abraham want to do for them? Remember what he wanted to do in Genesis 18? What did Abraham ask them to do? Three men showed up, and what did Abraham say he wanted to do for them? What do you want to do? You want to make them a meal, right? Yeah, he wanted to make. Do you know how long it would have taken to go kill an animal? You know, prepare that animal, cook it, get the bread, all this. And the angel is sitting there. They want to tell Abraham about his son. They waited for hours. That's how patient they are. Do you remember when they finally went to get Lot? They're going to take Lot out of Sodom and Gomorrah because they're going to get him out of that city. They showed up, right? Look at how they treated Lot. Think about what they did with Lot. You know, here he was vexed about what was going on. He was unhappy about it. But his daughters weren't really on board yet. They couldn't even convince anybody else to come out with them. But how long did they wait for Lot to get everybody he could out of that city who wanted to go with him? How long did they give him? Did they give him an hour? 2 hours? How long did they give Lot to collect everybody he could? They gave him, yeah, all night, right? Get everybody you can. It's like he had a day to go collect everybody he could to leave. That's how patient angels are. When it came time to leave in the morning, when they got up in the morning, you remember the story? Was Lot ready to go? Nope. And what did the angels have to do? They took him by the hand and they got him out of that city. God being merciful to him. See, this is how God's family members behave. This is what they do. They love justice. They love to be merciful. And they walk humbly before their God. See, just if you want to know what it's like to be in God's family, just read about those angels. Because that's why they're in the Bible. They show us what his family is really like already. Now, the key that we have to provide is faith. This is what God is looking for in all of us this weekend. And I hope when you leave that this is the key that you go home with, is that the most important thing you can do in the days to come is every day ask God to grow your faith. Every day. That's the only thing that's going to save you in the end. This is what makes the difference between the people who make it and the ones who don't, is do they have faith? That's what God's looking for. It's a faith where you trust God in everything that happens in your life. Everything. Not just some of those things. You trust God in everything. You don't want to be a double-minded person, like James says. Somebody who, like, one moment trusts God and the next moment you don't. Because, you know, when something good happens, you say, oh, thank you, God. And something bad happens, and you say, ooh, I'm not too sure about that. You can't be double-minded. You've got to have the kind of faith that really believes and trusts that God is in control. And that he's the coach. He's got the game plan all figured out. He's going to teach you through daily practice how to become part of his family. But you got to trust him. You've got to have faith. That's the piece that we got to provide. So we know in Hebrews 11, you know, you know these passages really well, that faith is being sure of what we hope for. Now, I like to throw other versions up there because sometimes we get so used to hearing a version, you hear it and you can recite it by rote so well, you don't even like notice what it says. So sometimes other versions really help you to sort of focus in on what they actually say. This is out of the NIV. That faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. That's what faith really is. You're sure because you trust the coach. You're sure that what he said is going to work. And you're certain of the stuff you can't see. You can't see the whole game unfolding in front of you yet, but you're certain you're going to win. Because he promised you're going to make it. That's what faith is really all about. And without faith in verse 6, look at that. If you don't have faith, it's impossible to please God. Because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists, things that you can't see, and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. That's the hope, what you hope for. He is going to reward. You're going to make it into his family. And that's what faith does. That's the key to our life today, is learning to become a faithful person. Grow your faith, and every day ask God to send his angels to do whatever it takes today in your life in order to grow your faith and the faith of your friends, the faith of your family, the faith of your ecclesia. This is what makes a difference in our life. Now, when you go back through, and that was Hebrews 11. Back in Hebrews 3, Paul had talked about that generation Moses was dealing with, the generation that didn't make it in the land. They didn't enter in because, he says, they're not going to make it. They went astray in their hearts. They hadn't known God's ways. They never really developed a relationship with God. So he swore in his wrath they would never enter his rest. And you find that Paul says that, look, they couldn't enter in because of unbelief. They didn't have faith. That's why Hebrews is all about what makes a difference in our life is that we have faith. Hebrews 3, they didn't make it. Hebrews 11 is all about people who did do things by faith. Look what faith motivates people to do. You stoop down and you serve an ecclesial life. You don't worry about who looks the greatest. You don't worry about who comes across as being the most important. Jesus had faith. He wanted to save those disciples. He believed God was in control. He'd stoop down and wash their feet if that's what it took, in order to get them on board. And he does that at the Last Supper. Now, that's one of the last things he left with them. Now, the kind of faith that we want is a faith that's very active. You don't want a faith that just sort of sits there in an armchair like a couch potato and just says, well, I've got faith. God's going to save me. That kind of faith doesn't do anything. James balances out the problem that developed in the first century where people just thought, well, if all you need to do is have faith, well, I just have faith. I got lots of faith. God will save me. But you don't really have to do anything. You just sit in your chair and you just take care of your own life and you don't worry about anybody else. So James would say, for example, in chapter 2 there, what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but he doesn't have works? Can his faith save him? Well, if a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, oh, depart in peace, be warmed and filled. Can you imagine that? You come here to the gathering, and you didn't bring a coat. You have no sleeping bag. You don't have any food. You don't have any money. And somebody says, oh, hope you have a great day. Hope you sleep well tonight. Yeah, I don't do anything for her. You know, you don't line up a sleeping bag. You don't get any clothes for them. You have what kind of faith is that? Well, you don't help other people. That's the problem they were running into. If you don't give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Right? And also, faith by itself, if it doesn't have works, it's dead. It's a dead faith. But, James would say, going back to verse 16 there, instead of one of you, that would have been those people who thought that all they need to do is have this faith. He contrasts and he says, but someone like him or the faith people that have works will say, you have faith and I have works. So show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Now you notice the NASB got that right. Most of your Bible versions put the quotes in the wrong place. And they think that James stopped like way back in here, that you have faith and I have works, and they stopped the quotes there. But really they should run all the way through, because he's contrasting the difference between these people who just think, well, I have faith, I don't need any works, I just have faith. And James says, no, wait a minute, you know, you have faith, I have works. You show me your faith without your works, but I'll show you my faith by my works. And then he goes on to describe the two characters, Abraham and then Rahab, the harlot, people who were justified by works. Because our faith must be active. It's got to be not just a faith where you say, well, I believe, and you sit there in your chair, but it's a belief that causes us to get up and do things for other people. And Abraham did. He believed that God was going to take care of things that Abraham couldn't do. He believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. And Rahab, when she hid the spies, you know, here we had a Gentile harlot who's operating on faith. And James would say, well, that's the way it works. And faith without works is dead. You've got to have a faith that does things for other people. So what faith does is it trusts God in all circumstances of life. You go back and look at people and you wonder, like, why are all these events recorded in the Bible? They're to show us how people lived who lived by faith. This is what faith generates people to do. So Daniel's three friends in the fiery furnace, they'd say, look at to the king, I don't care what's going to happen one way or the other. Our God might save us, he might not, but we're not going to bow down to your image. Because we believe that the coach is right. Whatever he chooses to do, it's going to be the right thing. That's what faith does to people. It helps them to trust God in all circumstances. You can see that with Joseph when he was in prison. David, when he was running from Saul and he gets back to Ziklag, finds out that all the people were gone. All their wives were taken, their kids are gone, the city's burned, and his own men want to stone him. And he strengthens himself in God and believes that God's in control. Or Jesus, when he asks in the garden, is there any other way? You know, this is what faith does. It convinces you that God's right, you trust God, and you keep on going in life. And faith does that to us. It will allow us to move forward no matter what happens, confident that God's working in our lives. So you start looking at, well, what are you going to take home from this? Well, when you go home to your own families and your ecclesias, some of you that came here tonight, maybe you are frustrated with your family. Maybe you don't have the greatest brothers and sisters in the world. Maybe your parents, you're upset with them. God has put you in a situation where he's hoping you will learn to trust him. He can use that situation just like he did with Joseph. When Joseph's in prison, or Joseph with his brothers, or wherever Joseph was, God used that to his ends in order to develop faith in that man, Joseph, and he can do the same thing with us. You might be frustrated with your ecclesia right now. Maybe things aren't going well. Maybe things are in trouble. I know a lot of people in this area with fellowship issues right now. It's a frustrating time. But you don't throw your towel in. You don't give up on God. The whole Bible's full of trial periods like this. Trouble, trouble, and trouble is all over the Bible. And faithful people trust God. They keep going. They work their way through it and realize God will use those troubles to save us. You may not find the boyfriend or the girlfriend that you want so bad. That may not happen for you. Maybe God isn't going to give you that person you really want so bad. But faith will motivate you to trust whatever God does. He's finding the right person. He is going to help you. It is going to work out, but you've got to believe. You've got to have that faith that believes that God is in control. Maybe you've lost your job or your health, or somebody in your family has. Or maybe you experience an accident or some kind of major health issue. Faith will generate in you the motivation to keep moving forward. You're going to learn to develop a relationship with God where you trust Him like you might trust the most trustworthy person that you have in your family today or some friend that you have. You're going to trust God far beyond that. You will trust whatever He does because you'll learn that He's doing it all for your good so He can save you and bring you into His family. And although you may not understand right now at this moment why it's happening any more than Joseph did, at the moment, he didn't know why, you know, Potiphar's wife was doing that to him, why he was going to be thrown in prison. But that was the way God was going to elevate him to be second in the kingdom. Now, and who could have seen that ahead of time? You can say the same thing with David when his men wanted to stone him in Ziklag. You know, he went back to Ziklag and his men wanted to kill him and David strengthens himself. Do you know in 1 week he was king of Judah? 1 week later, he had been elevated to the kingdom. Saul was dead, Jonathan was gone, and David finally became their king. 1 week is all it took. But that's what faith does. You trust God in all circumstances of life. So God wants you to get a relationship with Him where you trust Him like a father. You trust Him like a parent. He's got your best interest at heart. And that way He can raise you into His family. That's what He's really after. So I hope this weekend, as we go through the classes tomorrow, and that really when you take this weekend on into your future, when you're doing your readings at home, you go back to your ecclesias, you're involved in your families, your CYCs, the goal of all of this is that we want to have a relationship with God. We want to use this weekend to enhance that. Not just our relationships with each other when we talk and we get along, but the goal is to develop a relationship with God where you trust God. You thank God every day for what He's doing for you. You learn to appreciate all the things that He's done in your life. His angels that are out there working for you 24/7, 365 to develop you to join His family forever. What a wonderful God that we have, that He cares that much about us, that He's willing to put out all that effort, willing to give His own Son, send His angels all the time to try to work with us, to change the way we think and live, so that He can invite us into His family forever and we can join the angels in their work. It's a great hope that we have, and hopefully young people will get an opportunity this weekend to work on that. Thank you.